You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Hello everyone, my name is Adam Lent. I'm Director of the Action and Research Centre here at the RSA. Welcome. It's my very great pleasure to introduce David Willetts tonight. He will be speaking as part of a series of lectures we are running ahead of the election on the big policy issues being debated over the next few weeks. David, as many of you will know, is one of the leading thinkers in the Conservative Party and wider politics, of course, and has been so for 25 years. He's been an MP since 1992 and has served in a wide variety of roles in government and in opposition. And between 2010 and 2014, he was, of course, Minister for Universities and Science. David has had a long interest and a very big impact on skills policy in Britain and on wider issues of knowledge, education and capabilities. And it's on that subject that he'll be speaking for us tonight. So without further ado, please welcome David Willetts.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Adam. It's great to be here at the Royal Society of Arts. I appreciate the opportunity of joining you and talking about a cause close to my heart, skills and knowledge, and several of the kind of dichotomies that I want to go through that I think often confuse the debate about education and skills. Well, I would like to begin by inviting you to imagine a beautiful, large stained glass window dominating the end of a massive hall. And from a distance, with its different windows in beautiful arches, you would think that it was the far end of a church with classic images of the saints. But close up, if you inspect the images, you see that actually they are not religious figures. They're not saints. They're actually images of workers in all the great trades and professions of the early 20th century. Where there should be a bishop or a saint, what you instead see is a miner, though admittedly a rather Michelangelesque miner. There's someone doing electroplating. And it's not just manufacturing. There's even a filing clerk in this stained glass window. And as some of you may know, the stained glass window that I'm describing is the stained glass window in the Great Hall of the University of Birmingham. And when Joe Chamberlain created the University of Birmingham, he wanted a university which served the local community, the businesses of Birmingham. He saw no reason why it shouldn't train people in all the great vocational crafts of the area. And he commissioned a stained glass window for the Great Hall that was a celebration of those vocational skills. And that stained glass window matters quite a lot to me. I come from Birmingham. My father was a student at the University of Birmingham. And one of my grandfather's earliest memories was being taken to the opening of the University of Birmingham just over 100 years ago, because his father, my great-grandfather, was one of the glaziers who put the stained glass window in to the Great Hall. And Joe Chamberlain, true to his belief that there should not be divides between academics and artisans, wanted the workmen who had worked on the construction of the university and the Great Hall to be there for the ceremonial opening, which is how my great-grandfather and my grandfather got to attend. And I think that this tells us something about the passion, the emotion that these skills evoke. And we've had some great examples much more recently and in a different genre than the stained glass window. Think of Richard Sennett's book, Celebrating Craft. Think, from the other side of the Atlantic, of what Malcolm Crawford has written in the celebration of the skills in the of the motorbike mechanic. For people of my generation, it's Zen and the Art of Motorbike Maintenance all over again. But there is a paradox. That stained glass window celebrating those craft skills is in a university. Richard Sennett writes his beautiful books about craft from the LSE. Malcolm Crawford, when he's not repairing motorbikes, is teaching philosophy at an American university. So some of these celebrations of craft and skill themselves emanate from higher education. Is there a connection? And I want to investigate the connections in the course of my talk, but I can cut straight to the answer, if you like, with quoting a beautiful essay from David Hume on the, this is an essay on the liberal and the mechanical arts. And he said, and I quote, "An advantage of industry and of refinements in the mechanical arts is that they commonly produce some refinements in the liberal. Nor can one be carried to perfection without being accompanied in some degree with the other. The same age which produces great philosophers and politicians, renowned generals and poets, usually abounds with skillful weavers and ship carpenters. We cannot reasonably expect that a piece of woolen cloth will be wrought to perfection in a nation which is ignorant of astronomy or where ethics are neglected." And I still think that is one of the most eloquent arguments, that skills and aptitudes that sometimes get divided up into different categories depend on each other, and a culture which is good at has the application and the precision of mind to be good at some of them is going to be good at all of them. So what I'd like to do now is, in the next 10 minutes or so, just quickly review some of the divides which both, I think, make the debate in Britain terribly confused, but also stand in the way of the recognition of the kind of connections that Joe Chamberlain wanted to celebrate and which David Hume was writing about. And let me just very briefly review some of those distinctions and then conclude with the knowledge-skill distinction. Now, one kind of distinction is between types of institution. And we're told that universities are academic institutions, but further education colleges, for example, are vocational. But many courses that you do at university are vocational. In fact, on one estimate, 2/3 of all university students are doing a course which is essentially a license to practice. They can't work as a doctor or a nurse or as a lawyer or as an engineer without having got, or even a chartered surveyor, for example, without having got that university qualification. So there is a large amount of vocational study at university. And this isn't some 21st century or 20th century corruption of the university. The medieval origins of the university were to train the priests, the administrators, the lawyers, that even the very small medieval state and church needed in order to function. So it isn't the case that universities are somehow the opposite of doing vocational stuff. A lot of the stuff at university is vocational. And then, when you look at FE colleges and the courses that can be done at an FE college, it's perfectly possible, and indeed thousands of students do, to do an A-level in philosophy at an FE college, if that's what you want to do. So we should recognise that at further education colleges, supposedly vocational, there's a large amount of academic study, and that at the university, many of the courses, although they're studied with an academic rigour, are actually fundamentally vocational in purpose. And so one begins to see that academic and vocational are not alternatives. You can be doing a vocational course, but if you do it in a university environment in a more academic way, you may do it in a way which reflects more back on the discipline that you are studying, but it is certainly a vocational course. Then there are different types of learning, another distinction I wanted briefly to investigate. And science, some of the sciences and the debate that's going on at the moment about the science practical and its role in science A-level or university studies, I think brings that out very well. I was talking today to a colleague at King's College, where I now have the privilege of being a visiting professor, and she was saying how when the university recruits people into science subjects, some of them have done an A-level, and the fear is increasingly, with practicals disappearing from the assessment process, that they will not have got much practical experience of working in the lab. Other people have got a BTEC, and they're far better at some of the practical lab work that you need, but they may not have done as much theory as in the A-level. But in order to succeed at university, you needed both. There are very few science disciplines that you can study at the university level without being familiar with practical experiments, either in wet labs or in the physical sciences. So there are many disciplines where doing things with your hands, I've given the example of the sciences, but it could be in other areas, really matters. Where you want to, if you're on the art side, you want to perform, you want to create. If you're studying a modern language, you want to be able to speak it and communicate in it. So the practical capability matters, not simply the academic learning. Another distinction, which I find particularly frustrating, partly because I'm a victim of this problem, is the two cultures, the famous C.P. Snow two cultures. Arts v. sciences. And I have to say that I think that the problem of the two cultures is a particularly acute problem in England. I think it's a real problem, and I think it arises, the more I study the subject, the more I'm convinced that it arises from a specific feature of our English educational system, namely the requirement to specialise at the age of 16. The decisions that we force on 16-year-olds in our education system, the English one, not Scotland, of course, in the English one, are pretty much unique in the advanced Western world, and they create an appalling dilemma in which you have some people like myself. I did history, English and German as my A-levels. I greatly enjoyed them, but it did mean that I missed out on quite a lot of the intellectual advances of the modern world. And there are other people opting for physics and chemistry and maths, as our son has done, for example, who haven't written an essay or had to communicate in a foreign language or do anything like that since the age of 16. That is the practical origin of the two cultures dilemma in England. And again, it is not a fundamental feature of these disciplines that they have to be kept apart. It arises from the way in which we construct our school system. Let me turn to another distinction, and this is a real one that does exist, and that is the two main routes into the jobs market. The route via higher education, and we've now got almost 50% of young people going to university and on into the world of work from that. And secondly, apprenticeships, where the coalition has quite rightly invested in the expansion of apprenticeships. And there is a kind of romance around the apprenticeship, and I suspect it goes back to those emotionally charged images and references that I began with. And it is incredibly valuable to be able to learn on the job as you can with an apprenticeship. But it is just worth remembering some of the reasons why so many young people actually opt for higher education. The apprentice initially starts off without fees and loans, though, of course, the student doesn't pay the fees up front there. It's a graduate repayment scheme, really. But he's earning from day one. However, the evidence, and it keeps on coming in from the economists who appraise this, is that in the long run, year on year through their careers, a graduate on average, and there are always exceptions, but a graduate on average is going to enjoy greater earnings growth than an apprentice. And it looks as if the reason is that the apprentice skills in a particular trade or business activity are not as flexible. They don't enable you to go with the extraordinary changes in the modern jobs market, whereas it looks as if the higher education qualification gives you a set of skills that means you are set up for life in a way that an apprenticeship may not be, unless it's in an incredibly stable, long-term industrial sector. And we don't have that many of those. There's another interesting contrast between them, which we in the coalition are beginning to wrestle with. I think that the apprenticeship in its traditional form was when you left home to go and live with a master who taught you a trade, or perhaps for whom you worked as a servant. But it was a life cycle event. It was when you left the parental home and became and lived in someone else's home. You didn't become fully independent. After your apprenticeship, you'd then be a journeyman, moving around, and then would be a master in your own right, creating your own household. And so these vocational routes had a significance in the underlying pattern of people's lives. What has happened is that apprenticeships, with a small number of exceptions, have ceased to be residential, whereas going to university is residential. That experience in the stage of the life cycle of going away from home but still being in some kind of supervised arrangement, some kind of transition to adulthood where you're neither dependent on your parents but nor fully independent. In other words, the crucial features of the traditional apprenticeship in the life cycle are now, if anything, one of the crucial parts of the university experience. Now, there are a small number of residential apprenticeships. I visited in HMS Salter, near my constituency on the south coast, the rail track apprenticeship scheme, which is residential and operates alongside naval training courses. And one of the interesting questions that we're going to have to start wrestling with is, as we create these national academies in vocational skills, an excellent initiative, what are we going to do to enable someone to travel across the country in order to get vocational training at one of these academies? The funding of the maintenance costs of moving away from home is actually quite an important part of the higher education experience. Some apprentices can do it out of their earnings, but by and large, the model is one in which starting an apprenticeship does not involve leaving home. And in the coalition's vision of every person having the opportunity of either an apprenticeship or going into higher education, we shouldn't forget the third option of becoming a technician, something that David Sainsbury, one of my predecessors in BIS, was eloquent about, and quite rightly so, because, of course, an apprenticeship requires that you already have a job, and we are insisting on that. But a technician qualification is well-suited for those activities where you may get your qualification before you get your job. And it's important that we invest in technician training, which is often what some of these HNC, HND, BTEC, City and Guilds courses have historically offered. Let me now, in the last few minutes, just turn to the last big tension, which I also find incredibly frustrating, and that is skills v. knowledge. Now, there is a classic picture of facts pouring facts into empty vessels as being boring, and the mastery of skills as being what the future is all about. This debate has been going on for hundreds of years, and in fact, over Christmas, I reread Charles Dickens' Hard Times and read properly the picture of Gradgrind's view of education. And I have to say, the picture of Gradgrind as drawn by Dickens is, I think, very unfair on some of the great Victorian social reformers and parliamentarians. What Dickens is denouncing is a preoccupation with facts. He thinks facts kill human sentiment and feeling and emotion, and he makes Gradgrind's preoccupation with facts seem like death, which they almost are literally to his sadly deprived kids. He makes the collection of facts by Gradgrind and his deploying of argument in the House of Commons, because, of course, he is a member of Parliament, or I think Dickens calls it the national dust heap. he's very dismissive of that. But looking back, the great Victorian social reformers, and right through into the Fabians and beyond, were collectors of facts and evidence. This was not a purposeless, random activity. When they were trying to understand the sources of cholera, it was when they started collecting the data about where were the people who got cholera and connected it to polluted water supplies that they were able to make progress in social advance. When Edwin Chadwick went round the country with his blue books, much mocked by Dickens, he was assembling data on public health that led to the great Victorian health reforms. When Joseph Rowntree was painstakingly mapping poverty in York or London, he was doing it in order to drive a debate about the entitlements of people to a minimum benefit if they were unemployed. So I think that the caricature of facts in the character of Gradgrind is Dickens doing a great disservice to one of the most powerful social reform movements that surrounded him in mid-Victorian England. And this remains relevant today because knowing stuff does matter alongside having skills. And increasingly, and I've been influenced here by recent work such as Daniel Willingham's book in the US and Daisy Christodoulou's work here, increasingly I recognise that skills are very hard to distinguish from knowing stuff. And there are lots of examples. I'm going to give some a range of examples, but let me begin with an example from my own experience. Now that I'm going to be standing down as a Member of Parliament in my last 3 months as an MP, looking back on 20 years or more as a Member of Parliament, I was trying to think about, for example, if an observer came to sit in on my surgery watching me handle a child support case. And I've had quite a few CSA cases in my 20 years as a Member of Parliament. I hope they might think, well, after 20 years, he's quite skillful at doing that. He's trying to extract the key bits of information he needs from this frustrated person. I hope you'd feel that he was quite good at keeping him or her calm in very distressing circumstances. And that he had a skill to write a persuasive letter to the child support agency about what had gone wrong in this case. But those skills are basically the result of 20 years of handling these cases and slowly, and without really being conscious of it, building up a memory of how you have handled dozens, if not scores, if not hundreds of these cases over the years. And the letters that worked and where you made progress and the ones that didn't work and the surgery cases that reached a satisfactory conclusion and the ones that didn't. And gradually distilling that into how you handle a CSA case when an unhappy constituent comes to see you. Whether you call that a skill or knowledge, it's a very hard distinction to make. One of the famous experiments on all this is the great chess player memory question, which is, if you have a game of chess and you have a chessboard and you put it briefly in front of a serious chess player and an amateur chess player, and then take it away and ask them what the disposition of the pieces on the chessboard was, the professional chess player has a much better memory of the, much more likely to be able to give you a broadly accurate account of the pieces on the chessboard than the amateur. However, if you, so is that that chess players have just got better memories in some sense? If you, however, then put under their noses a random distribution of chess pieces on a chessboard, the professional chess player is no better able to remember their location on the board than the amateur chess player. So it's when they mean things, it's when they come imbued with significance that you are able to develop these type of skills. It comes from knowing lots about chess. And this applies not simply in the more intellectual activities of chess. Matthew Syed's book, Bounce, applies a very similar methodology to table tennis. And it might look as if a table tennis player, a very good table tennis player, has an extraordinary natural gift for reading the ball, spinning the ball on the return, for reacting quickly. What he shows is that for a time, a large number of England's table tennis players were all coming from a small town in the Midlands. It wasn't because there was some extraordinary genetic fluke that large numbers of people gifted in table tennis happened to be living in this town. There was a coach there who was remorselessly giving practice sessions to kids who were remotely interested in table tennis. So they were playing lots of table tennis. And the more table tennis you played, the more skilled you got at identifying exactly what was going to happen to a ball that was coming in your direction. The skill and the knowledge went together. When I discussed once at a meeting with Peter Scudamore of the Football Association why we had a declining number of English football players in the English Premier League and what it was that put us at a disadvantage, he said a good Dutch player through their teens will by the age of 16 or 18 have had hundreds of hours more football practice and training than an English teenager will have had. There will just be more of a structure to invest in them. And I conclude from this that the practice, the process of learning, is both in many ways a memory of lots of stuff that has happened, a memory of previous matches, a memory of previous chess matches, a memory of how you've handled previous table tennis matches. It's both a memory of stuff, but it also is express, or if I may say so in my case, a kind of memory of lots of CSA cases, but it expresses itself as a skill. And you can't master a skill without knowing the stuff. So what I've tried to do very briefly this evening is to try to bring out how some of the disjunctions, some of the divisions that are the bane of the debate about education and skills, I think can and should be overcome. And the most important of all of those is the distinction between facts and skills. Thank you very much indeed.
Well, thank you, David, for a really forensic and really enlightening account of those core debates. I'd like to just kick off by just talking to you about some of those final points you're making about the distinction between skills and knowledge. It seems to me that many of the criticisms that I hear that are directed at the education system, particularly in the UK at the moment, or in England and Wales in particular, is that the sorts of skills that young people are going to need to meet the challenges they're going to face in the very rapidly changing labour market we face are skills like entrepreneurialism, creativity, empathy, independence of mind. And I wonder to what extent you think that focusing down on knowledge, and particularly the testing of knowledge, really can teach those sorts of more generic skills which we hear from business organisations and others young people need as they come out of school and university.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's very hard for those type of qualities, you say entrepreneurialism or empathy, to be learnt directly. I think they're the kind of qualities that come from doing other things. You achieve them via other activities. And so I see no harm in someone who wishes to go into business getting some education in the framework of company law or some knowledge of corporate finance. I don't think they are, again, I think it gets dangerous if we think of these as kind of some kind of special quality that's not an emanation of what you've been learning. On testing, I think that there is a lot of testing. I fully understand there's a lot of testing, and I think that there is an argument that the amount of testing has increased, is increasing, and ought to be diminished. I recognise that argument. But the testing, one of the equally important things is how the testing is constructed. And one of the things that's made I think had a very distorting effect on the way schools work, is construction of tests. So they try to assess skills separately from assessing your knowledge of stuff. And that's why some of these school exams can be quite dismal. There's this kind of section to assess your mastery of skills. And I'm not sure that that's a useful way of doing it. But knowing stuff is a great way of, in turn, mastering some of those skills that are valuable in the 21st century.
And I mean, I found what you were saying early in the talk about the weight of vocational education that does occur that we often don't realise. So you mentioned 2/3 of university students are on vocational courses. Do you think that we have enough flexibility in our education system and in our training systems to adapt to what many think is going to be a really very significant change in the labour market and in the sorts of vocational areas that people are going to need to go into as things like artificial intelligence, the internet comes? So I'm thinking, for example, you mentioned people studying medicine and law. If technology really transforms the labour market in the way we expect, do we have the necessary flexibility to be able to produce young people who can, you know, meet those labour market needs?
Well, I think to some extent, I think that there are still the great historical disciplines are not just worthwhile in their own right, but incredibly useful. Being able, the critical skills that come with reading a lot of literature, the intellectual training of philosophy, or physics, or another rigorous discipline. I think those are still incredibly valuable. I think what one can detect as a trend is just the rise of maths, the importance of maths in a wider and wider range of disciplines, because it is the most sophisticated kind of form of symbolic analysis that we've got. And I, from my thinking, my own background, increasingly when you talk to university academics, they'll say, we've got someone doing politics who's maybe not done any math since the age of 16, and they're doing a term on the American political system, and we set them some American political science papers investigating voting behaviour in presidential elections using some regression analysis. And they panic, you know. They haven't. This is something for which they've had no training. And I was very keen, and it was able during my time as minister to put some funding into programs like Sigma, which is basically a friendly maths resource on every university campus. And I've seen it in Birmingham and Loughborough for the panicky art student who suddenly discovers who thought they'd last seen any maths at the age of 16, and suddenly discovers they really need it in order to do their discipline seriously. So I think there is the rise of maths. And going a bit further, I have been quite influenced by people like Conrad Wolfram, that it may be the case that as you know, the power of our laptops and our mobile phones and other devices grows, the type of maths that you need shifts. There will be some things which are now so effortlessly automated that some of them still worth knowing our times tables, but there may be some kind of math stuff that it was logarithm tables when I was a boy. Those have basically bit the dust. But constructing a function which you can use in quite a sophisticated way to identify a pattern behind data, that is a skill that probably, given the power of computing, more people need to learn earlier. So I think even maths itself changes as the environment, as the kind of tools you've got at your disposal change. But yes, I would hazard the view, and we do have to take a view of the future, that the rise of maths is probably a significant trend.
Thank you very much. So I will open up to questions and comments from the floor. I'll take about two or three points. Gentlemen there.
David Hudson, RSA Fellow. Do you think in retrospect it was a right decision to rebrand the polytechnics as universities and therefore lose the distinction between the academic and the technical education at that stage?
Martin Ross, a journalist. You're saying knowing stuff in the title of your lecture. Do you have a definition of knowledge that you're working with here?
Chris Minter, London Borough of Hounslow. You didn't say very much about communities. There seemed to be an emphasis on individuals learning things and compiling data. I just wonder how much community of people around you, in adult education we often talk about communities of practice, how much does that give a context to learning, to apply things? And also the community as a way of doing things. If you think about RSA projects, we learn things to apply them to make social change. And that seems to be giving something back to communities and society. And I suppose, finally, having listened to Matthew Taylor recently about talking about policy, and we seem to produce an awful lot of facts and reports, but it doesn't seem to translate into effective policy change in this country. And I just wonder if you have any thoughts on that.
Okay. Thank you. David.
Three very good questions. I mean, I think on the polytechnics, I don't mind... In fact, I positively welcome the fact that those institutions got the name university. And in many advanced Western countries, institutions like that would be called university. And they don't have an agonized debate in America about the name university, which applies to a whole host of institutions. I think in a way, though, what happened... was when polytechnics got the title university, it in turn led to some changes in their behaviour. There was a kind of mission drift. There was a sense that they had to get more like some kind of classic Oxbridge model of what a university was. And some of them, I think they're beginning to rediscover this, but kind of, for example, didn't attend to their roots in the local business community. And often these institutions had initially been created by local business people who wanted locally to be training people in the skills of, you know, the earlier stages of the Industrial Revolution. And some of that was lost. But calling yourself a university shouldn't be a reason to lose them. And we should have a broad and tolerant definition of university so that people don't all feel they have to chase after being like Oxbridge. On knowledge, well, I guess I mean, and I'm sorry to be so crude about it, facts and data, but recognising that they are contested and subject to interpretation. So not naive about that, and recognising that there is a penumbra of kind of interpretation around any given fact, and knowledge is not simply a memorisation in a sort of pub quiz way of stuff without it making some sense and having some shape to it. And on communities of practice, yes, I was thinking of the individual. But you're right. Some of these studies do show that when you have these extraordinary surges of performance of a group of table tennis players in one place or chess players in another place, it's often a group of people who are all benefiting from an unusual concatenation and maybe some really committed coaching or some incredibly good resource or the creation of some exciting competitions. So communities can gain, not just individuals. And on facts and policy change, I think that the... Sometimes, and my pushing it back on the research community, one of my frustrations with the research community is they would put a lot of effort into the sophisticated collection and analysis of the data, and then the kind of final paragraph or two of the paper would be an almost cavalier throwing away some throwaway lines about what the policy implications were. And one of the reasons for the great role of the IFS in all of these debates is the IFS puts the same amount of rigour into analysing policy options as it does into the observation and collection of data. And there is an entire skill in thinking about policy, thinking how... And some people who are incredibly sophisticated in collection of data have an incredibly crude picture of what policy does and how it works. But it's equally a sophisticated subject in its own right.
Rob Nathan, occupational psychologist. You quite rightly point out Matthew Syed's book, Bounce, and also I've read his book on 10,000 Hours, and he talks about the importance of, in order to sustain the ability to practice for 10,000 hours, you need to sustain the motivation. Yeah. You haven't said anything about how we might generate the motivation to be fascinated so much by facts that we attain the 10,000 hours.
Gentleman there.
So I'm a maths teacher. One of the things that always horrifies me is that how, although people are required to study basic skills in maths and English until 18, the pass rate of people who fail at 16 and then continue to age of 18 is perpetually stuck in the low single digits. And I wonder if you believe that there are basic skills such as maths and English that everyone needs to get up to be productive in the labour market. What can we do to the system to be more effective at ensuring that everyone does actually get those?
Thank you. We have some questions or a question from Twitter.
Hi. Keith Herman on Twitter, you did slightly touch on it already in your speech, but he wanted to hear a little bit more about, with regard to employable graduates, how do we ensure that employer demands with regard to skill don't crowd out the essence of the student learning experience?
Yeah, so in addition to that, as Helen Trudgeon, I work in recruitment, what do you feel employers should be doing? Because universities are producing graduates with the skills and the knowledge, but recruiters are finding that employers are looking for people with that skills and knowledge, but the experience as well. Now, if you've come out of university owing a fortune in your fees, you're not necessarily going to want to be doing unpaid internships.
I think the point about motivation is well made. It is a fair... and in some of my discussions with the educational purists, you do... I do touch on this. And this is where I'm quite interested in what some of the new education technologies do and where, an ugly word for an interesting phenomenon, gamification. Because a lot of the skills that go into computer games, for example, are essentially skills at keeping our attention. And they're very relevant for a lot of education as well. And I think education can learn from the... expertise in some other disciplines at keeping people focused and on task and wanting to stay focused. But I agree, I think that is an important issue. On maths, although I'm not going to redesign our education system today, I'm writing a book about education at the moment and universities, and one of its themes is that we specialise far too much too early. I would like us to move to a system where we did not expect 16-year-olds to take these very, these crucial decisions so early. And I would certainly hope, I would like to be in a country where people were keeping up maths in some way or other to the age of 18, but also some other disciplines as well. And, you know, when I had the great good fortune in my 4 years plus as the science minister to sort of get to know people in the physical sciences. And we had fantastic particle physicists. But our particle physicists couldn't, by and large, couldn't speak any other language. whereas most other countries' particle physicists just accepted that they should also, clearly they were speaking English and often had another language as well. So they had just kept the breadth going for longer. In other words, it's two ways. Not just people on the outside needing maths. I think it cuts both ways. Employer demand and employer expectations. I personally think that you've got to start somewhere. Sometimes employers, I think, they mustn't be unrealistic. They can be a bit unrealistic. Expecting a 21-year-old who's been wrestling with the demanding educational system also to be already familiar with how their company works, which does seem to me sometimes a bit unrealistic. You can't... people do have to start, and there is a transition into fully functioning, valuable employment. On the internship issue, I don't think it's actually particularly related to the fees and loan. I think that's separate, and the repayment terms on our graduate repayment scheme are not very onerous. It's 9% of earnings above £21,000. It shouldn't stand in the way of young people making their careers. But unpaid internships do need to be very effectively policed, and some of them are scandalous. Some of them are clearly in breach of minimum wage rules, because if it is work and employment, and there are some pretty clear measures of that, like you are expected to be around for certain hours, then it should be paid. And there is a lot of mythology around, well, you're only doing it for 6 weeks or whatever. That doesn't change the law. You are covered by minimum wage legislation. And I was pleased that in our time in BIS, we worked closely with HMRC to get them to get employers to comply. And so I think some internships that are unpaid ought to be paid as a matter of compliance with the law. When you then move on to the genuine unpaid internship, which is a real, can be a barrier to social mobility, one thing that I emphasised to Les Ebden, who heads the Office of Fair Access, in our last guidance to him, was that it is a legitimate use by universities of what is now the substantial access funds that they have to support students from disadvantaged backgrounds into internships they would otherwise not be able to do. Because when you look at the data, we've actually made great progress in getting more young people from disadvantaged backgrounds applying and going to university. One of the reasons why I'm pretty robust about the university fee changes that Blair brought in and then we added to is that in that 10 years, the percentage of people from the poorest backgrounds going to university has doubled. So we're doing well on access. But the most, to my mind, the most dismal evidence now is that if two people leave university with the same degree level and one of them comes from a poorer background, then when they go back into the jobs market, the person from the poorer family background will on average earn less than the person from the more affluent background, despite the fact that they have got the same level of university accomplishment. And that ties into things like social networks and finding jobs, and that's why it's a legitimate use of access money for university to overcome that kind of barrier. And then finally, yes, I mean, all these subjects, I should have said, to the question from Twitter, I should have said, these are all disciplines that are worthwhile in their own right. People study physics or history or whatever, or law, because they think these are interesting and worthwhile disciplines. And, of course, there's a whole set of issues about how they're paid for and what their labour market outcomes are, but I try not to forget, and none of us in this debate should forget, that goes right back to the first question, part of what motivates people to get their nose to the grindstone and get on with this stuff is they just think it's very interesting and worthwhile in its own right.
Could I just very quickly just follow up on that very interesting point you made about people's career paths after they leave university? Because, as you said, one of the reasons behind that is some very deep social issues like networks, etc. Mm. I mean, what can, if anything, what can policy do about that?
Well, as I said, I tried to give you a practical example because one wrestles with this. I mean, the good news is that university is, on most measures, It's the first stage of the education process where people from disadvantaged backgrounds outperform. And one of the reasons why I am very pro-universities and think they do a fantastic job is that there is a... Whereas, sadly, I know the evidence is disputed a bit, but it does look as you go through school, the stages of schooling, the kids from the disadvantaged background fall behind. When they get to the university, for a given level of A-level performance, if you come from a disadvantaged background, you are likely to get a slightly better degree. So that is encouraging. That's the good news. But the battle is not then over. And as I said, I gave you one... I wrestled with this when the evidence starts coming in, but the fact that you then outperform at university doesn't feed through. You then have another knockback when you're going into the jobs market. And that, as I said, was something I discussed a lot with Les Ebden in the last 18 months. And there is now increased... and I won't repeat what I said. I suggested one policy lever. A second policy lever would be that we actually have quite poor data on destinations. And some of the destination data, after 6 months, is a pretty poor quality indicator because people's careers have not really settled down. But then when there's a 3 years measure, but that hasn't got a very high compliance rate. What I would love to do, and we would need better access to HMRC data, you'd obviously protect the confidentiality, is to be able much better to track people through the jobs market. I would love to be able, goes back to grad grind and these facts. The facts about which school you went to, what college you went to, what your A-level grades were, which university you went to, what employment you're then in, tracking people through, anonymised, would transform the British debate about social mobility. Mm. And they can do that data linking in the US. It's very hard to do it in the UK, partly because of administrative obstacles, partly because of legal obstacles.
Fascinating. I think we've got time for a couple more questions. Yes, at the back there.
Mr. Willetts, you talked about the problem of early specialisation in education. Sorry, my name is Priscilla Chadwick, I'm a fellow. But actually, the government at the moment is planning to abolish AS levels, which were a key initiative to keep that balance for longer. And in my experience, very large numbers of students chose two science subjects and two arts subjects through to 17 plus. And for some reason, this government is killing it off. Could you explain that to me?
Hi, Anthony Painter, I work here at the RSA. David, I was interested when you contrasted the sort of adaptability of certain skills and knowledge against the obsolescence of certain skills and knowledge, being apprenticeship or apprentices and graduates. And I'd be interested to know where you think the responsibility might lie for enhancing the adaptability of those whose skills might become obsolete, whether it's the individual themselves, the government or employers.
Thank you. And final point here from the gentleman there.
Oh, yeah, Jeff Wolfing, I'm a fellow. I think it was just a point of clarification, if I could ask, about the point that, Adam, you made around skills that organisations seem to be saying they're looking for in terms of things like creativity and innovation and resilience and all these types of things. Were you saying, David, that in your view, those things come from studying some of the other more mainstream subjects that we've been used to studying, and therefore, in their own right, they're not necessarily subjects or things that potentially should be part of the education system?
Thank you. David?
Yeah, I mean, there are pros and cons of the AAS change, and I think that the education ministers would say that it was actually a response to another concern that you raised, which is the amount of testing. Yeah. So you weren't doing exam. It wasn't summer after summer as you go through your teens, being dominated by exams. But I know there are arguments the other way. In Cambridge, for example, Cambridge University feels very strongly about it, and I respect the points they make. On who keeps skills up to date, if you have long, continuous, stable employers, then the employers can. When you have big structural change in the economy and those employers disappear, you may need retraining in something completely different. You may need to do something different. I think when it's within the firm or within the business sector, a lot of the responsibility does lie with the employer. When you're talking about structural change, I think more of an obligation falls on all of us to fund those type of programs. To take an extreme and powerful case still, you know, what miners do when coal mines close down, and there was public support for that, and that's where you can't say you're going to just enhance your skills as a coal miner. You're going to say you're going to move into a different industrial sector. Then finally, on this kind of skills and what employers want, two final points. I mean, first of all, I think it is very hard directly to teach creativity, innovation, resilience, the kind of qualities. I think they're admirable things, but they aren't. I'm sceptic about whether programs can teach you them direct. It may be the case that the best way to develop resilience is to do real tasks, trying to get your head round a foreign language or understand something difficult in maths or apply it in something physical in design or technology, and after finding it difficult, eventually to crack it. Mm. So that's why I think mastering stuff can be a means to these qualities. And secondly, you're reporting what employers do indeed say, but then you do just get the employers who also raise the awkward question of what they know, what graduates know, what school students know. And I find it actually slightly more, say, in the university sector, it's what you get more explicitly from some of the conversations with people overseas. I remember talking to a minister from a Gulf state who was saying that, you know, they sent their students abroad to do kind of hydrocarbon engineering in different countries. And the concern they had was some of them who came back from some universities in the UK, they weren't confident they knew enough about hydrocarbon engineering to be put in charge of an oil field. They weren't complaining about empathy, but empathy and creativity all matter. They just wanted them to know the stuff to operate an oil field efficiently. I remember talking to someone running a big Anglo-German company, and I said to him, what's the difference between the British engineering graduates you take and the German engineering graduates? He said, and he didn't get again into sort of empathy or stuff, he said they'd both by and large done the same textbooks and knew the same kind of stuff on paper. The difference was that as part of their course, the German engineering students would have operated a lot of modern equipment, and the British students were less likely to have had so much practical experience of operating kit. So he would put a German engineering graduate in charge of one of his plants overnight, but not a British engineering graduate. Which, incidentally, is a conversation I reported to the Chancellor when I said we needed to get more funding in for some of the high-cost courses like engineering. They're the theories you should meet the extra costs. I didn't think we were properly meeting the extra costs so that the universities could afford to be properly equipped in their engineering departments. So you also do have these really practical, nitty-gritty conversations with employers. And the employers who turn up and talk about creativity and empathy, I respect that. But I did hear also a rather different set of concerns from employers, and we shouldn't forget those.
Thank you very much. Well, I think as David might have mentioned in his talk, he's stepping down from Parliament at the election. So hopefully that will give you more time to write and speak on the subject, which there's few subjects that are more important than this. So thank you very much. Thanks to all of you for your excellent questions, and just finally, just to thank David formally for his contribution. Thanks very much.
Thank you, David.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, thersa.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.